we're ready for our last case of this morning, Tamer against Kraft Foods. Mr. Porter?
May it please the court, I'm Steve Porter from Madison, Wisconsin, appearing on behalf of the plaintiff in this case, Lori Tamer, who also appears in person.
You didn't file a reply brief in this case?
That's correct. I did not. Your Honor, Lori Tamer is here today essentially to seek her day in court, to seek her right and chance for a jury trial on her claims of sex discrimination and retaliation related to her employment with Kraft Foods at their Oscar Myers division in Madison, Wisconsin. Lori Tamer was employed at Kraft Foods in 1991 on a part-time basis. By 1992, she was promoted to a supervisory position in the distribution department. She was promoted again in 1993 and served in the distribution department until July of 1996. During that time, her annual performance reviews were always in the range of meeting performance expectations. In that period, however, from 1993 to 1996, she had repeated problems with other male peer supervisors. Ms. Tamer was at the first level of supervision in the plant, in the distribution department. There were seven supervisors at that level. She was the only woman among them. She complained of being backstabbed by the male supervisors. Essentially, she complained that they never really accepted her because she was a woman, that they continually made false reports about her, that they interfered with her communications with her supervisors and with her subordinates, that they made derogatory comments in front of her subordinates and other supervisors, that they and that even her her supervisor, the head of the distribution department, gave her less of a raise for the same achievement that another male supervisor had obtained.
But we need to be clear about what theory we're proceeding under. Which of these claims are encompassed within the charges that she filed with the EEOC? For instance, there's this debate about the termination claim, but also I don't see discriminatory payment as one of the adverse employment actions you're complaining about. You're talking about the performance review, the close supervision, the 30-day notice, right, as each of which maybe you could comment. I don't see you bringing this as a hostile environment work, you know, sexual harassment case. Is that correct?
That's correct. It has aspects of a harassment case, but I don't think it needs to. I'm sorry?
I said it looks a lot like some harassment cases.
It does. There are cases, however, that say that supervisory actions in the form of things like performance and evaluations, performance evaluations, supervisory criticism and things can't necessarily constitute harassment. It arguably
they also can't constitute, I mean, we don't want to create a rule under which employers have a strong disincentive to give honest performance evaluations or to supervise their employees. And I think it's that that's the problem with those aspects of your case.
I'm not sure I understand. It's our contention, Your Honor, that essentially the district court sort of turned the summary judgment presumptions on their head. It's our assertion that they essentially took the supervisory criticisms of Ms. Tamer's supervisor as the truth unless Ms. Tamer could prove them false, and that her own responses specifically to those criticisms and her own assessment of her work performance and her responses to the specific criticisms made by her supervisor were not to be given any weight unless they were corroborated. I would submit that turns the summary judgment inferences on their head, and it assumes that Ms. Tamer, who's worked in this position for 6 or 7 years, has no credibility with regard to what her job requires or what the specific circumstances involve. I mean, she responded to the specific criticisms in detail, and she also allowed gave the supervisor information that would have allowed him to follow up and check up on it, which he never did. And he would, if he had done that, he would have found that many of his criticisms were not founded. Every time she showed him wrong, every time the hard data, like the production numbers, showed that Ms. Tamer was performing as well as anybody else, the supervisor backed off of that and said, oh, well, my real concern is your relationships with your peer supervisors, your response to your pages, things that couldn't be documented, things that were highly subjective, and things that Ms. Tamer did respond to, but would have a very difficult time bringing documentation, certainly into court, to prove that wrong.
So you claim that the productivity of her gang was as good as anybody else's. Is that well documented? Is that?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. We submitted production reports compiled by Kraft Food themselves, covering the period from November of 1997 through March of 1998. When Ms. Tamer left on her leave of absence, and those records indicate that the actual production of her truckers was as good as anybody else in the distribution department, and that in fact on the specific days when her supervisor Mr. Ulrich had sent Mr. O'Connell out to gather his own data on her to prove that she wasn't performing. It proves that the data in November that was gathered in that regard was inaccurate, and that in fact she was performing better than the supervisors that she was being compared to.
Incentive plan based on productivity in this plan?
Not that I'm aware of. So we think that there are at least contested issues of fact and inferences that should be drawn in favor of Ms. Tamer.
But, you know, we have so many cases which say in so many words that an employee's own sense of how he or she is doing isn't enough to show that what the supervisor has written down is a lie, is dissembling, that one does need other sources of evidence, because otherwise we would become just enmeshed in some reevaluation of every employment decision a company makes, which is not appropriate for a court. So I think that's why the rule is as it is. The district court correctly recognized that somebody saying, you know, I really think I was doing a good job, even though I assume that's absolutely genuine, is it enough to show that the supervisor is inappropriately, you know, lying and putting down an evaluation form that the employee isn't performing when in fact the employee is performing?
I understand the court's concern in this regard, but this is not a case where the employee simply in very generalized and vague terms says, well, I was performing well enough. This is a case in which for each meeting that they met and specific criticisms were given, the plaintiff has submitted detailed responses to those specific criticisms, and has indicated that through her understanding of the workplace that is equal at least to the supervisor, who wasn't even around in that department as long as she was, I think does create a contested issue of fact. That in conjunction with the substantive objective numbers in the production reports and in the things that are verifiable. I mean, for example, we have the attendance reprimand in October of 1997, where Ms. Tamer is reprimanded for not attending on a day where in another written criticism she's accused of some inappropriate performance. So the supervisor himself contradicts himself. And more than that, I think there's evidence that much of the, or not much, but a significant portion of the criticism that the supervisor gives her is founded on the reports, inaccurate reports to the supervisor of the from the peer supervisors, who are the very supervisors that Ms. Tamer has been complaining of and has complained have not accepted her, have derogated her because she's a woman, and have interfered in the past with her. With her performance and given false reports regarding her to the supervisor. And this is a supervisor who didn't check out any of this stuff. He didn't even go when Peter Schumacher said to him that she had screwed something up so that the second shift production line had to be shut down. Mr. Ulrich took that just at face value, he didn't even bother to go to the supervisor who was on the second shift to check out Ms. Teamer's story that it was inaccurate.
Now, why? Eventually, though, before she's terminated, Kraft offers her a position in the ham slice department, where it says, using names in the letter, you will not have to work with the following people, the people about whom she'd been complaining. What more could Kraft have done?
They could have offered her a job at corporate.
Well, but why does it have to do that? I mean, it offers her a job that's similar to the job that she'd had before. It's hard for me to see this as a case of, you know, discrimination. Usually when you say there have been problems in one area, you think about another area.
This was, of course, the same. When Mr. Schumacher wanted to preserve his rights to be eligible for a job in corporate, the supervisor specifically readjusted his meets performance evaluation so that he could do that.
He does not strike me as a comparable, though. He basically is told, you know, resign or be fired, and he gets out. So I don't know that she wants to look like him.
Well, Your Honor, in direct answer to your question, Ms. Teamer was in no position to go back to a plant where she was very likely to run into these guys because they work in distribution. They're all over the plant. They distribute the raw materials in the plant and the supplies, and they pick up the product, and they're all over the plant delivering to the production line. What's more is that Ms. Teamer's husband, who also worked at the plant, returned to the plant and became aware in January that Mr. Alrich had returned and was going to be the night supervisor on the second shift and would have been in her chain of supervision. And frankly,
is that your record?
I believe it is. I believe it's in her affidavit.
Who was going to be the night supervisor, did you say?
The plant supervisor was to be Mr. Alrich. Left the plant in May of 1988. Ms. Teamer left in early April of 1988, and Mr. Teamer, at the time that they made their first offer for her to return unconditionally, was December, and then they later repeated that in February of 2000. In the interim, Mr. Alrich had come back to the plant as the second shift plant manager. It's also in his deposition, by the way. Anyway,
you want to say? I mean,
the point I'm making is that her therapist advised her not to go back under the conditions, and this was because of injuries that they had perpetrated upon her. The Latham case that I cite from the 11th Circuit and I believe the Townsend case also echoes the notion that a failure to mitigate, so to speak, on the part of a plaintiff because of disabilities that have been caused by the defendant themselves should not be construed against.
With regard to the sexist comment that was made, I think your brief says that was made in connection with her. But is there any admissible evidence to that effect?
I'm sorry, which one are you referring to, sir?
Well, you know, the comment about, you know, the women don't make very good foremen or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, Mr. Sathre's affidavit indicates that it took place in a context in which he heard them discussing Lori Teamer.
You have a minute for your rebuttal, Les.
Okay, I'll save it. Thank you.
Good morning, Christian Poland on behalf of Kraft Foods. I think Judge Wood has highlighted some of the difficulties that the appellant has with her case, and I'd like to discuss those briefly as well as a few additional ones. In the district court, plaintiff and now appellant did come to the court with a strategy of introducing a lot of facts and a lot of concerns and a history of complaints about her work at Kraft. Rightly, though, the district court focused on the claims that were not time-barred and the claims that were actually at issue when everything was said and done. And so those were four claims, an annual review that was issued in December of 97, some, quote, close supervision, end quote, that was from December of 97 to March 98, about 3 or 4 months, and then a 30-day verbal warning that if she didn't improve her performance, she would be terminated. Then finally, we have the termination claim, which comes several years later after an extended paid disability leave on account of depression, which the plaintiff appellant claimed was due to her employment at Kraft.
Mr. Poland, why should we assume that a supervisor who, at least on one occasion, made a really very unpleasant sexist remark isn't skewing his comments in an annual performance review? Why do we have to take that absolutely at face value?
I would suggest that we shouldn't take it at face value, that we should look at it in terms of the kind of analysis that this court has promulgated for direct evidence. And
well, direct evidence or indirect, I mean, I don't know that we need to get into that, but my point is, you know, we usually say, well, you know, it's a performance review, but we have recognized that people can, you know, build a file, if you will, that will be designed to get rid of somebody you don't want, and if that's because of an impermissible reason, such as the person's sex or race or what have you, then we have a problem. If it's a permissible reason, the individual's just an unpleasant sort of person or whatever, then not a problem. But here we have, you know, the background of this sexist remark. We've got the fact, as Judge Cuddy was talking about, the production statistics don't seem to add up the way he said they did. Why do we need to give the benefit of the doubt to this?
Two responses, Your Honor. As for the production records, that was something that the plaintiff believed would help her case in the district court, to suggest and to provide some kind of evidence of her production. That was never something that was criticized by her supervisor. And so that was sort of, again, different sorts of facts to try to get at it at a different angle. There was never criticism of her performance numbers. And in fact, if you actually look at the record, those performance numbers were not admissible into evidence. They were documents that she actually took with her from Kraft and were never authenticated at the district court, and so those weren't useful. As to the comment,
They were kept in the ordinary course of business, I assume, weren't they?
But there was no testimony to that effect, Your Honor, and that was one of the difficulties with the evidence.
I mean, all his criticism was, things that didn't... I assume her job was to get the production out primarily, wasn't it?
Your Honor, certainly that was part of the job. This was not a production in terms of how much you kind of run off the line. This was a much more subjective and difficult to analyze type of production. It's really the speed of distribution, the level of complaints that are generated from the other departments who are actually producing the materials, in terms of when you're supplying them with raw materials, when you're picking up the materials that have come off of the line. And so the production numbers were very difficult to interpret, and that was part of the problem. The plaintiff had her own view about her performance, and she could look at the numbers and say, but see, I'm good in these certain areas. And her supervisor was saying, you may have been good in those areas. I'd like you to improve in these other areas. And this other list is what resulted in continuing criticisms of her performance. Now,
I find one difficulty here that, you know, there's not very much specific being said about what was he criticizing, and what was her defense? It's sort of, is it all generalities?
Well, and actually, Your Honor, there is almost so much particular that it was difficult for the plaintiff to establish something that would overturn summary judgment, because he was so specific about her performance. And what she did was blame other people. She claimed that others would steal her data when she was supposed to turn it in. The kind of criticism that her supervisor offered, she would come back with either an excuse or, she was criticized for not responding to the other departments when they would page her to either deliver materials or pick them up. And she would come back and say, well, my pager was broken. And those sorts of excuses are what her supervisor was saying. You know, I can't really accept all the excuses, nor can I even investigate all the times that you say that I need to go out and find out what the true story. Ultimately, it was the plaintiff's duty on summary judgment to show that he didn't even believe these items. It's the good faith belief test. And so all of this, kind of he said, she said evidence about her performance, was kind of a dead end in the discussion.
How about this sexist remark that was made? Mr. Porter says that it was reported to have been made with respect to her. Now, isn't that getting pretty close to sufficiency of evidence of discriminatory intent?
It's not, Your Honor, and that's for several reasons. There are a few components that are required for that sort of direct evidence. I don't believe that the record actually does establish that when the affiant's deposition was taken, he was able to say that the statement was about the plaintiff. In any case, the words that he used or merely that this is a, you know, a tough place for women, something like that. The problem was...
I would have found it pretty offensive just to, you know, if somebody had really said that about me, but I thought you were arguing temporal distance and so on, isolated remarks, et cetera, but does that fit with Reeves? When it's the decision-maker who's making this comment?
I think it does. Actually, I don't think Reeves specifically addresses when or when not to use direct evidence. But if direct evidence is to go to a particular employment decision at issue, then it definitely has to at least include the plaintiff's name in the statement or a context which would clearly indicate that. It would also have to indicate that it was about a decision that was pending or was under discussion. In this context, it was after hours. This was a stand-in janitor who was eavesdropping on a conversation, and it was just a bunch of guys talking. I agree, Judge Wood, that this is not an appropriate statement.
How many other women were there that this could have been about at the time?
There were several female supervisors during the plaintiff's tenure. When she started out, I believe she was the only one. There were at least three or four during her 6 years there. And because we don't know when the statement was made, of course, she couldn't establish that it was about her. And even if she had, because of the affiant's statement that he couldn't place it in even a particular year, it could have occurred after the plaintiff was gone. And so that was, again, difficulty and, in fact, a bar to its consideration as direct evidence. Because it could have been made after she was already on leave, and, of course, that wouldn't then have had anything to do with her
right.
The adverse actions that she was claiming. I guess all of the evidence that she presents or presented on summary judgment is of no impact if she can't show an adverse action, and that was, Judge Wood, one of your comments. And this court has held so many times, I think probably at least 15 or 20 that I know of, that performance evaluations are not adverse actions. You've got to show some kind of tangible impact. And unfortunately, the plaintiff couldn't do that in this case. The annual review, there was nothing in the record that would show that there was some kind of tangible effect. She claimed that it interfered with a raise, and yet she wasn't even around when the raises were to go into effect. And the other record portion that she cites is testimony from the HR manager, who you would think would know whether if she had suffered some kind of loss. And he specifically said, looking at her performance file, I can't see that she lost anything. In fact, her bonus target was 5%, and she received in excess of 5%.
You don't think systematically building a record would qualify? I mean, this isn't just a single report or even several reports. It allegedly was going on for a long time with a specific intent in mind.
Your Honor, I would have to say that no matter how many papers are in the file, it doesn't amount to an adverse employment action under this court's decision, unless it has some kind of tangible effect on the job, a demotion, a loss of pay, bonuses, some kind of interference with the job. So even if you move past, and I guess I haven't even mentioned the failure of the plaintiff to satisfy her administrative prerequisites as to the termination, that, of course, is an adverse employment action, and yet she wasn't able to show that that was within the scope of her charge. I might comment just briefly on this court's recent decision in Gawley versus Indiana University, which again shows that there is only a very narrow exception to a charge filing requirement, and that's only if the adverse action is the result of or because of a charge being filed. The plaintiff in this case, up until summary judgment, had contended that her termination was caused by not the EEOC charge, but it was just a kind of a direct result of her depression, which led her to poor performance, which led her to kind of more depression and worse reviews, led to the disability leave. Then when she didn't want to come back from the disability leave or felt that she couldn't do so, then she was terminated. Well, that kind of causal chain, of course, started way before the EEOC charge, so it couldn't have been a result of that. In the end, pretext was certainly a big issue in the district court's mind, because looking at whether the plaintiff had established some kind of issue as to the good faith belief of her supervisor, you'll hear in the records that and in the documents that he issued to the plaintiff a lot of encouragement that he believed she could do this, and yet she was not willing to really embrace that and move forward. And so I don't think that it's possible to look at all of the criticisms that her supervisor offered and yet the encouragement that she could do this and say that he could not believe in good faith that her performance was not meeting his expectations. Looking then finally at the retaliation, I'd like to comment that the protected activity was a difficulty for the plaintiff. Certainly, as to these performance evaluations, she did sort of behind closed doors go to the corporate side of the plant and say, "Hey, do you have anything available for me over here? I'm not very happy where I am. In fact, I don't think the male supervisors treat me very well." Her supervisor never knew of that comment, and so that, of course, could not be the protected activity that would result in some kind of retaliation. She also went to the plant manager, again in the absence of her supervisor, who didn't know about that. The only time that her supervisor would have known this, and that it's in the record that he did, was when he was present. And yet the particular instance on which she could arguably show a protected activity is an open question in this circuit, and indeed even under the Supreme Court's recent decision in Clark County School District versus Breeden. And that is whether merely claiming or complaining about something that you believe is discriminatory is enough to establish protected activity. I think once you look at the supervisor's report as to what occurred at that October 97 meeting, which the plaintiff conceded was an accurate recollection or record of her complaints, you will see that nothing in that report and nothing that the plaintiff complained about was an unlawful act under Title VII, and therefore it cannot be considered protected activity. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We've got a little bit of time.
I have a full minute.
Your full minute.
Your Honor, I guess what this boils down to is there are contested issues of fact here. If nothing else, the Fathray affidavit and the production records cast doubt upon the criticisms made of Ms. Tamer, and we've got a detailed file built up on her that was built up against no other person except for Peter Schumacher, who was uncontestably verbally abusive and renegade supervisor. We've got detailed responses by Ms. Tamer to the specific criticisms, and they deserve to be taken note of. We have the Fathray affidavit. We have the production records. The production, in fact, Mr. Ulrich did try to use production statistics to criticize Ms. Tamer. And even when we were before the Equal Rights Division in the investigation, part of the laundry list of accusations against her in terms of poor performance included that. But we were able to pull the records, show them to the investigator, and then in the federal court action, they haven't bothered to try to criticize her based on production records anymore because they know it's fruitless to do that. But they did try that at one time. They sent Mr. Ulrich sent Mr. O'Connell out there to actually to gather those records. And they were false. They were misleading. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel, and we'll take the case under advisement. The court will be in recess till tomorrow morning.